Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, my voice is a little froggy, I think.
Yeah, you've been struggling with that for off and on for a while.
I've had a lot of allergies this season.
I know. It must have been a bad year for it.
Maybe so. I've been outside cutting a lot of grass. Maybe that has something to do with it.
Well, When I'm outside, I try to just jump in my pool.
Is that hay fever?
Hay fever or spring fever.
Something like that.
Yeah. You never know.
So if you hear me clear my throat at some point, I apologize.
I try to edit that out.
It's inevitable.
Yeah. If I'm not talking while you're doing it, I try to go back and edit that out. I don't figure people want that in their earphones.
Probably not. But it's hard because we're having a conversation down here. And inevitably, whenever I stop talking and you start talking, I clear my throat then. So it's like your natural conversational style.
Right.
But it doesn't work so well for podcasting when you have to clear your throat.
No, because I don't think people really want to hear that.
No, again, probably not.
Don't sneeze into the mic.
I'm trying not to. So for today's episode, we thought we would talk about the Bill of Rights and the amendments to the Constitution. Now, we've talked about the Constitution before. It's kind of hard not to when you have a legal podcast. I think it's inevitable. I think that's probably the third or fourth time I've used the word inevitable already on this podcast.
Well, it's inevitable to use it.
So, but anyway, we never really kind of went into detail about the amendments. We talked about them before and talked about some different issues that popped up with them, so we thought it might be kind of interesting to go through some of the amendments a bit deeper and get into some of the stuff that they stand for and what they do. Now, as most people know, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution make up what's called the Bill of Rights. Now, James Madison wrote the amendments, and they list specific prohibitions on governmental power. And this was basically in response because the states want a greater constitutional protection for their individual liberties. So basically, this is where the founders saw their chance to say, hey, we need to limit what the central government can do. So this is part of that whole, goes back to that whole struggle between federalism and states' rights.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting to note that the Constitution didn't technically go into effect until 1789. And then these amendments were offered in 1789 and were ratified in 1791. So they almost immediately, from the time the Constitution took effect, said, oh, we got to make a few changes here.
Yeah.
And they actually offered up 12 amendments.
Really?
But only 10 of them were ratified. The other two were not ratified at the time. And although one of them later on became the 27th Amendment.
What is the 27th Amendment?
Well, the 27th Amendment has to do with Congress giving itself a raise.
Oh.
And when it can give itself a raise. Then so that they don't want you sneaking them in the off years. They want you doing it before you're, you know, having to be voted on. It says it delays laws affecting congressional salary from taking effect until after the next election of representatives.
Oh, so basically they're voting on the next people's salary.
Right, yeah. If you vote it, you won't necessarily get it because you could get voted out.
When did the 27th Amendment become law?
It became law May 5th, 1992. That's how long it took from 1789 until then. So evidently they put something in place to that effect or put it out there. But it never was ratified by the states.
That's interesting. Well, the original Bill of Rights was actually strongly influenced by several different documents, one of which was the Virginia Declaration of Rights. The other documents would be like something like the Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, the English Bill of Rights, and the Massachusetts Body of Liberties. So there's kind of they took these Bill of Rights from other documents. It was kind of like, you know, real lawyering type stuff, because basically everybody kind of copies from everybody a little bit. There's no such thing as plagiarism in the legal world.
Well, why didn't they just put them in the original Constitution? They didn't want it too lengthy?
I guess not. And maybe that once the original Constitution was passed, they kind of looked at it and said, hey, you know what? I think we need to turn this thing down a little bit. Let's put some protections in here.
Well, I guess they probably had some states pushing back at too strong of a national or federal power.
Probably so. But I figured the first place to start with talking about the Bill of Rights would be the First Amendment.
Well, that would make sense.
It does make sense.
Since it's the first one.
Now, we previously had talked about the First Amendment, and we talked about freedom of speech, but there's actually a lot more in there than just freedom of speech. The First Amendment reads as this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So, probably aside from freedom of speech and freedom of the press, the Establishment Clause is probably the most prolific part of that Constitution, or of that amendment. And I would say probably, of all the amendments, the First Amendment has probably the most in it, I think, of any of the amendments. I mean, it seems to have the different clauses in there that really jump out. Because you have the Establishment Clause, Freedom of Speech Clause, the right to assemble in there. So, I mean, that's all in one fairly short sentence. So,
well, there must have been some stuff going on back in the states where they felt like that people were intervening, and so the federal government felt the need to put this out there. Hey, look, we're not going to do this. We're going to add this amendment that says we're not going to do it. We can't do it. It's against the law.
Well, I mean, the founders originally saw the ability to speak and worship freely as something that was very important in America to begin with. So I think they wanted something like that in there to start with.
That's kind of like in the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness part, huh?
Pretty much. Now, the First Amendment's Establishment Clause prohibits the government from making any law respecting an establishment of religion. So first of all, that means that basically the government cannot have an official religion. So contrary to what a lot of people in Congress and the Senate and wherever might think, we actually don't have an official religion.
Right. Well, that's because the Church of England and all that a lot of people were fleeing that.
That's true. And it also basically prohibits government actions from unduly favoring one religion over the other. So it's saying, basically the Establishment Clause says, we don't have a national religion, and you cannot favor one religion over the other. Which, I think that's pretty clear cut, that's what that means. It also basically prohibits the government from preferring religion over non-religion, or non-religion over religion. It's kind of like the government washing its hands completely of religion. There shall be no religion, we won't talk about religion, religion is taboo.
Don't bring it up at the dinner table, because somebody's going to get upset, then you're going to have a big argument and a family fight, so just don't bring it up.
You can bring it up at your dinner table. Don't bring it up at the government's dinner table.
Well, that's true. Don't bring it up at your dinner table if it's too big of a group. Like, if it's a gathering for Thanksgiving, you're liable to ruin Thanksgiving dinner.
That's true. I've seen it firsthand.
Religion or politics. Just leave them alone.
I've seen it firsthand. It seems like it's on repeat, actually.
You know what's funny to me, though? You say that, and I remember back when I was in junior high school, we were doing some kind of a school program, and I remember that we were doing a medley of patriotic songs, mm-hmm. and I had a little speech part in between one of the songs, and it said, I can't remember who it was that was saying this, but one of our founding fathers or somebody like that, and they were saying, has found that this is a Christian nation founded on Christian principles. And at the time, there's no pushback on that.
Right.
You can't favor one over the other, just like that their amendment says.
Just like it's actually written.
Yeah.
Now, it's going to be hard to say that there's not going to be some sort of religion interacting with government, because it's probably pretty much unavoidable to have to some extent. I just think that's probably a reality of life.
Well, a lot of the presidents have a presidential pastor or something, like Billy Graham was to a bunch of them for a while and stuff.
Yeah. The Establishment Clause can tolerate some. I mean, because it's just going to have to a certain degree. I guess the question becomes is, how much is too much? So basically, the Supreme Court has said in the past that... What's that?
That's what she said.
So basically, the Supreme Court in the past has said that religious invocations to open a legislative session and public funds to be used for private religious school busing and textbooks, and university funds to use to print public and student religious publications were okay. So those were some kind of limited type things. They've also said basically that some displays at courthouses, which were kind of over the top, and state funding, which supplements teacher salaries at religious schools, and over-the-top religious holiday decorations on public land were not allowed. So I think one of the ways that it's always important to look at these different challenges to the Establishment Clause and everything is basically, number one, how the issue presents itself, and also how the question is framed to the Supreme Court. And that's one of the important things, is that whenever you have an appeal, is how the question is framed. But the way a question can be framed can be very important on how the Supreme Court decides upon it. So even though you might have issues that seem like they're somewhat similar, they don't always necessarily make its way to the Supreme Court in the same way.
Okay.
Now, there are some interesting Establishment Clause cases I want to get into, and there's a very interesting test. But before that, I think we had a couple pending motions before the court.
Well, you know, in the past, Your Honorship, you have said a couple motions, and there wasn't but one. Tonight, you have understated the fact. We have not one, not two, but three pending motions, if it pleases the court.
All right.
It pleases me.
Who do we have on the docket?
We have the fine people at BetterHelp.com.
Is there something interfering with your happiness, or is it preventing you from achieving your goals?
Not right offhand right now, but I understand that that could be a problem.
That's right. If you need to talk to somebody, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
You can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online.
There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas. I know around here, sometimes it can be hard to find a counselor or somebody to talk to.
Absolutely. And especially in other parts of our state where it's really rural.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty metropolitan by some of those standards.
Not by modern society standards, but for West Virginia. This service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor.
And you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room.
BetterHelp.com is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed.
It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
So, if you find yourself in need of BetterHelp, then visit BetterHelp.com/court and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
And right now, Court Appointed listeners get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/court. That's BetterHelp.com/court.
For your peace of mind. And now, if it pleases your lordship, we'd like to go to Green Chef. They're back with us again with their list of healthy foods that they're trying to get us all to participate in for our own good.
Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company. Meal plans include paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore.
Green Chef lets you choose from a wide variety of easy-to-follow lifestyles with select organic ingredients. Recipes are quick and easy with step-by-step instructions, chef tips, and photos to guide you along.
And, like I said, with all those choices, there's something for everyone. With Green Chef, it's easy to eat well and discover new recipes every week you'll love to cook. You can switch up your meal plan whenever you're ready to try a new way to eat.
Green Chef makes cooking easy with dinner options that work around your lifestyle, not the other way around. Let Green Chef do the meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the prep work for you week after week.
Green Chef's expert chefs design flavorful recipes for your lifestyle that go way beyond ordinary substitutions. Diverse array of meal plans with plenty of options to choose from each week so you can actually enjoy sticking to your goals. It's deliciousness delivered.
Mike and I have actually made our own Green Chef meals in the past, and we have greatly enjoyed them as well as our families.
I do. I always look forward whenever I see a Green Chef box on my doorstep.
It's time to eat then.
Now, if you've listened to our podcast before, you've heard us talk about HelloFresh and how much we enjoyed it, too. Green Chef is now owned by HelloFresh to offer a wider array of meal plans to choose from. There's something for everyone.
Now, for a total of $75 off, that's $25 each of your first three boxes, go to greenchef.us/court75.
That's right. You can get $75 off. All you have to do, go to greenchef.us/court75.
And we say bon appetit. And now for our third and final customer of the day, it's our good friends at Sleep Number.
Now, maybe you've considered a Sleep Number bed but thought you couldn't afford one. But can you really afford another restless night's sleep?
I don't think that you can, and right now, there's never been a better time to save on proven quality sleep. Now, during the Memorial Day sale, a Queen 360 Smart Bed starts at only $9.99.
So many couples disagree on everything, which also includes mattress firmness.
Yes, firmness can be a point of disagreement.
Sleep Number beds let you choose your ideal firmness on each side, so it's just right for both of you.
Honey, is this firm enough? Yes. The Sleep Number 360 smart beds are so smart they sense your every move and automatically adjust to you, keeping you sleeping comfortably throughout the night.
And Sleep Number has been ranked highest in customer satisfaction with mattresses by J.D. Power. For 2018 award information, visit jdpower.com.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't believe us, go ahead and look it up for yourself, you know, just like Wikipedia, but go to jdpower.com and you'll find that.
That's right.
You got it, but really, you just ought to believe us.
Always, yeah. Come in during the Memorial Day sale and save $1,000 on a new Sleep Number 360 Special Edition Smart Bed for temperature balancing comfort at an exceptional value.
That's right, and remember, Memorial Day is my birthday, so you can buy a new mattress for my birthday.
That's right.
I mean, not for me, for yourself.
Celebrate Tommy's birthday the best way.
And keep your firmness to yourself. You'll only find Sleep Number at any of the 575 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Find the one nearest you at sleepnumber.com/court.
That's sleepnumber.com/court.
Mike and Tommy say, nighty night, little buckaroos.
So now, anytime you start talking about constitutional amendments and things like that, and you know, talk about different clauses inside these amendments, it's always going to bring up court cases.
Well, that's what shapes the law, is these court cases, isn't it?
It is. Now, one of the important court cases that discusses the Establishment Clause that I want to talk about is a case called Lee v. Wiseman. Now, this is a 1992 case, and it was actually decided only on 5-4, so it's a pretty one of those kind of close decisions. And basically, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, decided that it was unconstitutional for a public school in Rhode Island to have a member of the clergy deliver a prayer at graduation ceremonies. And the court held that it violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, which generally prohibits the government from establishing advance or giving favor to any religion. So basically, this is one of those cases where the clergy giving a prayer at graduation ceremonies ran afoul of the Establishment Clause. And in Providence, Rhode Island, where this took place, the principals at a public middle and high school were allowed to include clergy members in graduation ceremonies. So in 1989, the principal of Nathan Bishop Middle School, a Mr. Robert E. Lee.
Robert E. Lee?
That's right.
So that's what happened to him after the war.
He became a principal in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
He selected a rabbi to deliver prayers and provided him with a pamphlet that said Guidelines for Civic Occasions, which stated that public prayers should be written with inclusiveness and sensitivity, and told him that the prayers should not be sectarian. Daniel Wiseman, a parent of one of the students, objected to the inclusion of prayers at the ceremony and tried to get a temporary restraining order, but his request was denied, and the rabbi went ahead and delivered the invocation and benediction at the ceremony. And it actually had two references to God and one to Lord. So, pretty benign, really. I mean, it doesn't say anything in there. It doesn't really cater to one religion or the other. It's just talking about kind of a general Almighty God or Lord or something along those lines.
They could have said that omnipotent being in the outer universe.
So Wiseman, not happy about the situation and evidently having a bone to pick, sought a permanent injunction, and a federal district court found the prayers unconstitutional under what is called the Lemon Test, which is a U.S. Supreme Court test which had been outlined in a case called Lemon v. Kurtzman back in 1971.
So that's got nothing to do with an actual lemon, huh?
No, it is not a lemon test. Like, you bite into lemon, and if it tastes sour, then that violates the Establishment Clause.
Or you squeeze lemon juice on the pastor, and if he screams or something, that means it can't do it.
That's right. Or, you know, it's okay to have a prayer as long as you hold on to a lemon.
What about Led Zeppelin, the Lemon Song?
No.
That's not good either?
It's a tangerine, it's okay.
Oh, you know which one that is, don't you?
What, Lemon Song?
Yeah.
I don't.
You don't know that one?
Is that the one that wasn't released for a long time and then got released late or something?
No, that was a different one, but it's got the line in it, "Squeeze me, mama, till the..." No, never mind.
That's right.
Thought better of that?
Yeah, well, I said one time that I liked the Led Zeppelin titles of their songs because a lot of them come from one obscure line in the song, not necessarily the refrain. You know, a lot of songs, it's just part of the refrain is all it is. And in that, they would take one word out of it, just like Kashmir.
Uh-huh.
They refer to Kashmir just once in that song. And the same type thing in this.
So if you're curious what the lyrics are to Lemon Song, then basically just pop open your 8-track and look at the liner notes. And
there you go.
I'm sure the lyrics are in there.
Yep, that's right.
No, we don't need those anymore. We just Google things. So go ahead and search it up. Google it up.
That's not as much fun.
You know. Now, in 1991, the case was argued before the Supreme Court, and it noted that Lee's actions, deciding to include a prayer and selecting a rabbi, were attributable to the state. Obviously, this was a public school, and he decided to have a prayer, and he decided to have a clergy member do this. And basically, the court characterized it as a, quote-unquote, good faith attempt to eliminate sectarianism from the prayers. It was the opinion that our precedents do not permit school officials to assist in composing prayers as an incident to formal exercise for their students. The court took issue with the school's position that attendance at graduation was voluntary, noting that graduation is a rite of passage. According to the court, compelling graduates and their families to make a choice between missing graduation or conforming to state-supported practice leaves them with no alternative but to submit. The Supreme Court basically held that the prayer exercises were a violation of the Establishment Clause. So basically, they upheld the permanent injunction. So you got to think about that. This was a Jewish rabbi leading in prayer that made no mention of anything other than just basically an omnipotent...
Broad generalities.
But that was too much. So even trying to safeguard yourself from picking one side was too much for this.
Well, anything you say is going to be wrong.
Yeah, but I kind of see the Supreme Court's issue with it. If you have to come to graduation, it's a rite of passage, and if you don't feel like praying, then you're being subjected to it if you want to graduate.
Yeah.
Or if you want to attend graduation, rather.
Yeah, or else you'll be humiliated by those around you when you don't participate.
Yeah, pretty much.
But, you know, they can outlaw praying in school and everything else, but as long as there's going to be kids coming in there and having to take tests, there's going to be praying in school.
Oh, you should have seen me when I was taking the bar exam in Florida when I was first out of law school. I was reciting, Psalm 23 over and over and over?
Oh, God, if you just help me pass this one test, I swear I'll study from now on.
I felt like I was in the Valley of Darkness. I just wanted to get out of there.
Well, you were violating the law when you were doing that.
No, I kept it to myself.
It doesn't matter. You can't even think about it.
Well, trust me, I was thinking about
it. The thought police are going to get you next time.
They're not here. So, do you remember a couple episodes back we talked about stare decisis and precedent?
Yes.
Do you remember what those mean?
Stare decisis. Yeah, I remember I made the Vincent Van Gogh joke about that. That's what is that? Something, no, I don't remember. Something you decided, something that you was already determined, court precedents or something like that, that was already determined by other cases.
Right. Well, that's what precedence is basically if there's already a case on point which talks about that same issue, then you're kind of bound to it, especially if it's from a court that's above you or is kind of in your chain. And basically, stare decisis is kind of just the doctrine. It's the Latin term, and it's the legal principle that points to litigation. Basically, the precedent is what's controlling. So I mentioned that...
I kind of got there.
Yeah, you did. You talked yourself into it. Now,
it takes a while to rumble things loose back in the recesses of my old brain.
Now, when I was talking about Lee v. Wiseman, I mentioned the Lemon Test.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what the court did, when they're talking about the Establishment Clause, is they looked back through the history to determine if there was precedent. And there was precedent in this Lemon v. Kurtzman. And that's where they got the Lemon Test.
Hmm.
So I'm going to talk about Lemon v. Kurtzman.
So Lemon sued Kurtzman because Kurtzman was doing some kind of praying he didn't like, huh?
Well, I guess you're kind of close. So, now the interesting thing about this is that both Pennsylvania and Rhode Island adopted statutes that provided for the state to pay for aspects of non-secular, non-public education. This is about the same time, so it's Rhode Island in there again.
Yeah.
Now, this happens sometimes. You'll have two or three cases that are all very similar, and the court will take them all up at the same time. But only one gets the real recognition as the case, though.
The best one gets to have the name called after. I remember we went over that in one other one.
Yeah, because there were several different cases that all came up at the same time.
Yeah.
But basically, only the one case is the one you call that. You don't call it by the other name.
Even though there might have been three or four involved in it.
Yeah. So the Lemon v. Kurtzman was the Pennsylvania case. Mm-hmm. So whoever the Rhode Island people were, I don't know, and I don't really care.
But they had the same similar type circumstances.
They did, yeah.
They didn't get top billing, though.
No, they did not get top. They were not the lead. I guess in the theater that...
their chorus.
What's it called? A understudy.
Well, no, they're still in there. They're just not the lead.
Oh, okay.
The understudy, you don't see them. See, they don't come on stage unless the lead character, you know, gets pushed down the steps or something.
Well, I think Rhode Island, I think they're backstage too. I don't think they're getting out.
Oh, they're not getting out?
No.
They don't even hear any of their stuff, huh?
Well, they may make arguments, but I think they only write the opinion with regards to the one case, and then probably for the other opinion they say, see this case.
Ditto.
Ditto. What he said.
Sorry, ditto.
So the Pennsylvania statute was passed in 1968 and basically provided funding for non-public elementary and secondary schools, teachers' salaries, textbooks, and instructional materials for secular subjects. And Rhode Island statute was passed in 1969 and provided state financial support for non-public elementary schools in the form of supplementing 15% of teachers' annual salaries. So essentially they're kind of doing the same thing but in different ways. They're basically paying for non-public schools, assisting them. But here's the interesting thing. In Pennsylvania, the case was represented by citizens and taxpayers who believed that the statute violated the separation of church and state. And Lemon also had a child in Pennsylvania public school. The district court granted the state official's motion to dismiss the case. So basically, originally it was dismissed. In Rhode Island case, the appellees were citizens and taxpayers of Rhode Island who sued to have the statute in question declared unconstitutional, basically saying it violated the Establishment Clause. And the district court found in favor of them and held that the statute violated the First Amendment. So you had two different kind of inconsistent issues here. And that's one of the reasons why Supreme Court will oftentimes take something up is if you have inconsistent decisions amongst the circuits. So sometimes if one circuit decides one thing, the other circuit decides another, the Supreme Court may take up those issues because they want to settle it once and for all, because you don't want to have these kind of inconsistencies out there. You want to have good law that goes the same way for everyone. So basically the question as posed to the Supreme Court was, do statutes that provide state funding for non-public, non-secular schools violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment? And what they did is they established what's now known as the Lemon Test. And I'm going to tell you what the Lemon Test is right now.
All right, tell me. I'm waiting with bated breath.
The statute must have a secular legislative purpose. This is also known as the purpose prong.
The purpose prong.
That's right. The principal or primary effect of the statute must not advance nor inhibit religion, which is also known as the effect prong.
Mm-hmm.
And the statute must not result in excessive government entanglement with religion, also known as the entanglement prong. So it's a three-prong test.
Okay.
I see you giggling to yourself over here.
Well, it just sounds obvious that the terms they use, they attach to it. The entanglement prong.
And the things they factor in are the character and purpose of institution benefited, the nature of aid the state provides, and the resulting relationship between government and the religious authority. So basically, if any of those prongs are violated, the government's action is deemed unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Because private schools, even if they're, you know, religious schools, they do get some tax funding. They don't get fully funded, but they get some.
Right. They do get some. But this is basically, this was pretty hefty amount of funding.
It was funny, when I was reading before I understood exactly what we were doing for our category this week, mm-hmm. and I thought it was on all the amendments, and yeah. I was looking at failed ones and stuff like that. There was an amendment that was offered, and I want to say that it was in like the early 1900s, mm-hmm. that there was a particular senator that was on a rampage against Catholics, and that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to pass an amendment that would prohibit any tax dollars to go to a Catholic school or any secular school. And it didn't get done, but it was because of all the Irish and Italian that were coming into the country at the time, and he needed to do something about all these Irish and Italian that were coming in. They were all Catholics, so, and he just, for whatever reason, didn't like it. So, you know, I mean, us being Catholic, we are used to that sentiment.
That seems awfully discriminatory to me.
Well, you'd think so, but that was what it was. At the time, that was a problem. You know, every generation has their problems. At the time, that was seen as a problem, the influx of the Irish and the Italian. And, you know, I mean, right now you got Trump saying the same thing with our southern border.
Yeah.
That's a problem. Who knows, you know, 100 years from now when they look at that, well, what were they all upset about? Why was there a problem?
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to think in 100 years. Now, basically, the way this boiled down to was when they looked at these different statutes, is that the way they actually were implemented. Eligible teachers must teach only courses offered in the public schools, using only materials used in public schools, and must agree not to teach courses in religion. But basically, they found that 25% of the state's elementary students attended private schools, and 95% of those attended Roman Catholic schools. The sole beneficiaries under the act were 250 teachers at Roman Catholic schools. So basically, even though they put this language in there that said eligible teachers must teach only courses offered in the public schools, using only materials used in the public schools, and must agree not to teach courses in religion. But because the net benefit of that was only to Roman Catholic schools, it still ran afoul of the Lemon Test.
Hmm.
Because it basically...
It was promoting one religion only.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I mean, it did have a secular legislative purpose, in that, on its face at least, you would think that, okay, that seems okay. But the end sum of it was that basically it only helped Catholic schools. So,
Well, and I mean, you went to Catholic schools some. I didn't go to any Catholic schools. I went to public schools. Then I had to go to CCD classes on Sunday because of that.
Yeah.
But... they always have religion classes. I mean, you have your regular classes, but you all also have religion class.
Yeah. I mean, every year you have religion class.
Yeah.
I know even at through high school, they still have religion class all the way up to their senior year.
Right.
So the court basically found that the parochial school system was an integral part of the religious mission of the Catholic Church, and held that the act fostered excessive entanglement between the government and religion, thus violating the Establishment Clause. So the entanglement prong.
So it was entangled.
It was entangled.
Well, how did it get disentangled? Because, so it's saying that it was entangled so you couldn't send tax dollars there? Is that what that's saying?
Yeah, basically. Well, at least how this was written. I mean, I think that as if you're applying it broadly to probably public schools and...
There's other ones. I mean, there's, besides Catholic schools, we have Grace Christian.
Mm-hmm.
That's up the road, and I would assume they receive tax dollars too. They're a private school.
Well, I mean, that may be different now. I mean,
it must be.
If you look at the way this was written, it basically only benefited the Catholic Church for the most part. So, you know, possibly in this day and age, I mean, they might not run afoul of that. I don't know.
Maybe they were the only ones getting tax dollars. Maybe the other ones weren't.
I think that's exactly what was happening. Now, it's interesting, based upon this different test that came out, the conservative justices, such as Clarence Thomas and Scalia, basically have said that the Lemon Test was horrible. They hate it. And actually, there's a case called Lamb's Chapel for Center Morrich's Union Free School District from 1993, and Justice Scalia said the Lemon Test was a ghoul in a late-night horror movie. That's how he described it. He did not like the Lemon Test.
I think he could have done a better description than that.
And
you got to have a ghoul or it wouldn't be a late-night horror movie.
I guess that's true.
So is that the star? Is that what he's saying? I think he's saying it mucks up the works, but I think he missed that one. I don't think his colorful speech there worked.
Well, I don't think he was known for having much personality.
Oh, okay. God rest his soul.
The Supreme Court's used the Lemon Test in a bunch of different cases. Some of the most notable ones were Santa Fe Independent School versus Doe, McCreary County versus ACLU, and basically the court keeps the Lemon Test even though they've had chances to kind of get rid of it. So the court likes the Lemon Test.
Because it set precedents. It gives them a clear and concise precedence, huh?
That's right. They like their pronged test.
Well, you know, it's just like a guy calling, when the umpire's calling balls and strikes, you want him to be consistent. Maybe it's not really a ball or maybe it's not really a strike, but as long as he's calling them the same way for both sides, then that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You can live with that.
Most recently, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals applied it in the International Refugee Assistance Project versus Trump in 2017, basically upholding a preliminary injunction against President Trump's executive order banning immigration from certain majority Muslim countries. Because basically, if you think about that,
that's the government excluding a religion.
Yeah, I mean, you have an effect there, and it's also pretty entangled.
Mm-hmm.
I think Trump's got his hand in all the prongs. Or something.
He's a prong handler.
Yeah, maybe.
Instead of a panhandler.
So, but that's the Establishment Clause, and that's only one little part of the First Amendment, really. I mean, we didn't talk about freedom of speech.
Yeah, and yelling fire in a movie theater and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but we had talked about that before, though, so.
Right.
Everybody knows about that.
Well, that's the thing. When we got to looking at the amendments, there's a whole lot more to it than what you think. First of all, it's just, how do you even go about establishing an amendment? Why do we need amendments? What is everybody's role in it? So
what's my name? Why am I here? These questions and more
will be found on What's My Line. But it's an interesting process, and the fact the how they came about that, you know, immediately after the Constitution went into effect, here came 10 amendments.
Yeah. Well,
we got the damn thing there. Now let's fix it.
It's like
Thomas Jefferson wrote it. You don't think Thomas Jefferson made a mistake, do you?
Well, it's kind of like you get a brand new car from the dealership and they got to put that undercoating on there for you.
Right.
Finder's fee, undercoating, you know, all those good things. Tack them on.
Yeah. What's that other thing? A bump fee?
Yeah.
That one guy talks about on that one commercial. He says, we don't add on all these others. We don't add on, he lists all these things. The last one is, and a bump fee. We don't even know what a bump fee is, so we're not going to add one on there. And then he had a follow-up commercial later. He goes, and still no bump fee, because we still hadn't figured it out.
Well, when we joke about it, but I do think the Bill of Rights are probably pretty important. And I'm glad that we have them, because I think that they really are an integral part of our jurisprudence history.
I agree with you. Jurisprudence.
Jurisprudently?
Yeah, that sounds like a dessert.
I've had it before. It was a little too sweet for me.
A little too salty.
So what do you think about the Establishment Clause? Do you think you kind of have a understanding on it? You know, you ready to apply the Lemon Test?
Yes, I'm ready to apply the Lemon Test because that is what the courts make the decision on. So... You might as well go ahead and do it the way they do it.
You don't think it's a ghoul in the night?
No, I do remember one other one that it wasn't too long ago. There was a high school football coach that was hired. He was fired. Mm-hmm. That's just the opposite of being hired.
Yeah.
He was fired because he would lead his team in prayer before each game.
Yeah.
And they fired him for it. They warned him, I don't know, maybe more than once. They said, you can't do it. You've got to stop that. And he just said, look, I'm the coach, and this is where I coach my team.
Was that here locally, or was that
national? It was somewhere nearby. I think it was in Kentucky, but I could be wrong about that. But I think it was somewhere nearby here. And he just refused. He said, "I'm the coach, and I'm going to do it the way I do it." And he prayed before the game, and they fired him.
Well, we pray before our games for our soccer, but I'm the assistant coach at a Catholic school, so I think we're allowed to do that.
Well, that's true. Yeah, if it's a Catholic school, I would say you could.
We say a Hail Mary.
You can't. Yeah, that's a play.
It is. I wonder if you can get, if you're a football coach and you call a Hail Mary.
Oh, that's it. You're fired.
You get in trouble for that?
Yep, that's it. You referred to a secular being, so you're out of here. Don't call the Hail Mary. We got to change the name.
What can you change the Hail Mary to?
Oh, Hail Marine.
Oh, Hail Marine?
Yeah, Oh, Hail Marine. I just made that up.
I can tell. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I try not to cough from doing the briefs.
Well, you just about made it.
I know.
I just heard a sputter.
I'm sputtering out here. But Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions about what we talked about and see if he can remember them. So, Tommy.
Mike.
The First Amendment has a couple of different clauses in there. Can you name two of them?
It has the speech clause.
just the speech clause?
Yes, about freedom of speech.
Yes, freedom of speech. There you go.
And it also has the, it has a lot of them in there, establishment of religion clause.
I have a feeling you're cheating.
Free exercise of religion.
I know you're cheating because I see you actually reading it.
Right to peaceably assemble.
Yep.
Freedom of the press and the right to petition the government.
Good job. You got them all.
I just remembered them. They were coming to me as I sat here.
That's actually a lie. I watched you read them from the paper.
You have no proof of that. I didn't even have my glasses on.
Well, good job. 100%.
Thank you very much. It pays to study and bring notes.
Now, I asked you this question before when we were talking about court cases. What is stare decisis and precedent?
That's cases that are closely related to yours, maybe in the same area, decided by a similar or higher court that sets a precedent for the same type thing you're trying to decide. So rather than reinvent the wheel, you just use that as your guideline.
That's true, and you kind of interpret it to your case and apply the facts to your case to that prior precedent.
Just like the Lemon case.
Oh, funny you mentioned the Lemon case.
Yeah.
What are the three prongs of the Lemon test?
The entanglement prong.
Yes.
The establishment prong.
No.
Or something like that.
The
case prong.
Nope.
The long prong.
Nope. I'm going to go ahead and stop you there before this goes in a different direction. So the first is the purpose prong. The second is the effect prong. And the third one, which you nailed, was the entanglement prong.
Well, that one seemed the funniest. I kept picturing a vine wrapped around a prong.
That's true. And do you remember most recently the most famous Lemon test application in a court case? We just talked about it.
That was the one with Rhode Island and somebody else that was involved in it?
No, the most recent one.
Oh, the most recent one?
Yeah.
No, I do not remember what you called it.
Well, it was the Donald Trump case where he thought it was a good idea.
Oh, the immigration one.
Yeah, where he decided it was a good idea and it would probably be not... unconstitutional to ban Muslims.
But you didn't give us a name of that, though. It wasn't like something versus Trump or something, was it?
International Refugee Assistance Project versus Trump.
Oh, well, I guess you did say that now that you say it. It comes back to me now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I won't have to play the tape back just to see if you were lying to me. I guess I'll believe you.
I wonder who the advisors were that thought that was a good idea.
Probably, what's his name? Giuliani.
Maybe.
He can make anything... sound like a good idea, at least to himself.
I think they should have to pay back personally the taxpayer dollars that were wasted for having to litigate that, because how could you not know that's going to cause a problem?
Well, there's sometimes you just don't care.
Okay. I guess that's all we can say about that.
That's all I can say about that. Sometimes you just don't care. You just do it anyway and try to hammer forth.
Some people just want to watch the world burn.
That's right. And some people are waiting for their turn.
For every season, there is a...
Turn.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.